walk away.
Why?
Yeah, it's just blowing, but it's such a nice, fresh, fresh, fresh feeling. The air is so fresh. It's really delicious. Is the rabbi there?
Yeah, are we ready to start?
Oh, there we are. Good morning,
Rabbi. Morning, Rabbi.
Good morning. Is this a Josh or Jim who ate? I think Mike. I have I got 11:15 here. What time do you have?
Yeah, it's 11:20 here.
Okay.
Watch a little fast.
Okay, give me 1 second. Just give 1 minute. This is maybe joining on, so I want to make sure that everybody's got their audio working. People are joining online today. Okay, Laura, thanks. Laura, maybe you could just work with Rachel. She doesn't have sound yet, so just monitor her. And I just put a note up in red. Hopefully, Rachel sees that and she'll be able to access the sound. Just give 1 more minute.
Rabbi, is the computer access working? Because
yeah, it's working fine.
It is working. Okay, yeah. Fine. Because Naomi wasn't sure she'd be able to be on.
Yeah, it was only 2 weeks ago that there was a problem. We had switched,
oh, okay.
so it's working for the past couple of weeks now.
Beautiful.
Okay, Laura, thanks a lot for that. Okay, let's get Chumash. We're going to do is continue now in Kohelet, chapter 7, or to verse 3. So we take a look at that verse just for a moment till we start. So
are you on?
Was that?
Yes, I am, Doug.
Morning. Happy Mother's Day.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's start. 7:3. So the next point that King Solomon makes is as follows. He says, better is anger than laughter. Because with the with a negative face, meaning with a rejection or with a dissatisfaction, row upon him, when a person or a disappointment. So when that when there is disappointment, the heart is good. The heart is improved. Okay, Rachel, glad that you have the sound. Good. What exactly was the problem? Maybe just type it on the screen. It's good for us to keep abreast as to what the issues are and how they were resolved. So, Rachel, if you want to just type on the screen, tell us what the resolution was that you got the sound, that would be helpful. Thank you. Okay. All right, so what is this concept over here saying? It's a very brief verse. And sometimes those are the most difficult. Like when we learned in Rabbi Chaim's classes over the years, and we learned Tosfos. So Tosfos is one of the commentators. It's actually a group of people that commented on the Talmud. And he would, you know, when we'd have a very small commentary. Sometimes it was the hardest to pull out what was they were trying to tell us, because it was always written in a way that they wanted to prod the thinking of the reader, just like the Torah. And Maimonides writes that way, and Rashi, and all the great thinkers, they recognize that the benefit is in thought, and just to hand over and spoon-feed answers, it short-circuits the person from actually having to think about a problem and increasing and developing his ability to think independently. So when you have a very brief Tosos commentary, sometimes a bit difficult. Here also you have a very brief statement. He says, again, this is 7:3 in Kohelis, better is anger than laughter, because with disappointment, the heart is improved. Okay, now this is a very cryptic verse, and there's actually a very long Ibn Ezra, and I think we'll go through it. We'll probably do it in two parts, I mean, this week and next week. So he actually goes into a very nice exploration, which I think is very, very fundamental. And it's long, so I'm going to translate it as I read it. And you may want to take notes in case you have an English Ibn Ezra, unless you can read the Ibn Ezra yourself. Otherwise, since it is lengthy, he goes through certain sections, but he starts opening up a very important area. Okay. So, let me just wait a minute, see if you can get a hold of a pen and some paper, because I think it will be important just to take notes on this. We haven't done that in the past, but I think here it is crucial. Okay, so he says as follows, and he'll get to his explanation of the verse much later on. He opens up, though, with an introduction as to what's necessary, some background, some basic information psychologically. So he says as follows, this is the Ibn Ezra on Kohelis 7:3, and he says, quote, there has already been explained by the wise men of proofs that base their theories on proofs that there is in man three souls. You'll see it doesn't really mean souls, but you'll see what he means. He says there is in man three souls. One is the soul, or the force, maybe we could say, of growth. And this is also what we see also in the species of plants and herbs of the field and all trees. And they call this force a soul, or that which causes it to grow. And we see that this is it causes things to spread, to grow tall and to become wide, meaning physical girth and height. This is increased in many species of life. And it's through this first force that he's referring to. And he says this is also in man. And this also causes a person to grow, or causes growth to a certain, until a certain fixed time. And this force in man is also the same force that's responsible for desires and what makes him desire to eat. All right, so that's the first soul, the first force, the growth, of the, maybe you could talk about the natural properties. The second force, the second soul, is what he says is an animal soul. What does he mean, animal soul? He means that which gives a individual the five senses. It also allows a person to have movement and to travel from place to place. And this is also found in man. just like the first one. But in man alone is the third soul, is the third force. And this is what we call the neshama, right? Which literally is how we refer to soul today. So the first two we'll refer to as forces, just for clarity. And the third one we'll call the neshama, meaning the actual soul. And what is the properties of this third one, of the soul? This is what allows man to talk and to recognize between truth and falsehood. It also gives man his ability for wisdom. But the second soul that we refer to, the one that allows man to have movement and to have sensation, to have the senses, this is the in-between soul, and it sits between the two, meaning the other two. Meaning to say that the second force in man, which is responsible for his movement and his senses, that sits between the first force, which we talked about, the desires, and just all the what's responsible for growth in the person. So that first force, force an individual, and the third one, which is the soul, the metaphysical, those two, in between them is where the middle one sits, and we'll explain further. And just to clarify, yeah, this is basically what Freud and his division of three parts of the psyche. There's the ego, and there's the id, and then there's what he called the superego. But we refer to that as the soul. So the id is equivalent to the first force that he's talking about here. What desires? That part of an individual that just goes after desires and wants to enjoy eating and is sexual and is responsible also for just physical growth. So that is the only function of the id, right? But in psychological terms, we're not going to really get involved in the growth aspect of the human being. We're going to just remain. We'll talk about the aspect of the id which is responsible just for the lusts. So that's the id, and then you have the soul, which is the third, and that correlates to what we just talked about. And the middle one that Freud talks about is called the ego, meaning the person himself that when, like Ibn Ezra says, what does it mean the second one sits between the two? Meaning the ego, the person who that senses himself and makes decisions about where he moves and his emotions and his sensations, that's what chooses between, do I follow the id or do I follow, meaning do I just go after my lusts and my feelings and the physical urges? Or do I go after wisdom? So there's the person in the between, and that's what we sense as being us. When I say I am me, so when I sense myself and I think about me, that's the part that makes the decisions. And I'm pulled from two different sides. Okay? So that should be clear to all of us. All right. And again, the third soul, that's what gives us intelligence and speech, and we can distinguish between truth and false. And that is something which no other part of creation has. Okay. And God, now I'm continuing back in the Ibn Ezra. And God planted in man intelligence. This is what's also called the lev, the heart. And this is to allow man to fulfill his needs of every one of these three forces in its proper time. It also helps man strengthen him with the mitzvos. And it lets him stand properly on that which is proper for him. But this book, now Ibn Ezra, referring to Koheles, this book is not really written for this matter. For the subject of the of these souls, because it's very, very deep. And you're not, a person can't really understand this and stand on this, on the truth, and really arrive at the real truth of all of these different components of man, except after much reading and many books. And were it not for the fact that I needed to talk about these different portions of the souls, I wouldn't have brought this up at all. All right. But I mention this to understand the words of King Solomon, Ibn Ezra says. And he says, because there are many areas in his book that are very difficult. He says, in many places, he speaks, and then he says the opposite. I mean, King Solomon talks about one thing, and then he says the opposite of it. And because of this, the wise men of Israel, meaning the sages, they desired to store away the book of Qoheles. They didn't want it to be let out to the rest of the populace, because it seemed very contradictory. Now, storing it away, you see, you understand that they, it doesn't say they wanted to destroy it. It means that the wise men understood the truth, but they realized that it was not something which the populace would really be able to make heads or tails of, because there were so many contradictory statements found in the book. Okay. Laura, you're asking, is there a book like Qoheles which is written for this? Well, that would be the works of psychology, Laura. But you'll see as we go through this, we'll get some of the main ideas. Okay. So, as we said, Ibn Ezra is now quoting the rabbis, the wise men of Israel, that wanted to store away and hide the book of Qoheles because many of the verses contradicted each other. And he gives a number of examples now. He says, in one case, King Solomon says, better is anger than happiness. And that's our verse right here, right? Then he says the opposite. And he says that anger is really in the bosom of the fools. Now it seems like it's a ridicule of anger. Here he's saying anger is better. There is a good to anger. But then he says in another place that it's really something which the fools possess. And then he says, with much wisdom comes much anger. And then he says the opposite of that, and he says, you should remove anger from your heart. And then he says in another place, it's good that a person should eat and to drink. But then he says the opposite, which we read last week. He says, better to go to the boarding house than to go to a house of a party where you eat and drink. So, he, again, numerous contradictions. Another place he says, and quote, I praised happiness. And then he says the opposite in another part of this book. And he says, what does happiness do? And then in one place he says, what better is it for a wise man over a fool? And then he contradicts himself and he says that there is something better to a person who has wisdom. And then it says in another place, and I praise the dead. If you remember, because it's because they already are dead, more than living. In another place he says, it's better off to be a live dog than to be a dead lion. So at one time he praises death, and the dead. Then he says, no, he praises life. So you see, what Ibn Ezra is trying to show you is that there's numerous contradictions throughout the book. But you'll see that Ibn Ezra goes on later on and he starts explaining to him, he qualifies where you see a contradiction that really it's not. Like, for example, one time he says that it's really the thing that's contradicting the truth. Like, he gives a true statement. Another part of the book, there's a contradiction, but he says that contradiction is really not, it's not King Solomon's words. He's quoting the foolish words of man. And we've said this a number of times. So a person reading the book, though, does not know that. And it sounds like it's King Solomon speaking his own position, and then he contradicts his own position. But it's not true. He says a truth, And then in other plays, he'll say something which contradicts it, but it's not him speaking. He's quoting the foolish statement of the people. Okay, he goes on. I'll skip a little bit forward. Give me 1 second. Like another place he says, a wicked person won't have long days. And another place it says, the wicked person will have long days. And he says, it's good to fear God. Another place it says, there's wicked people that they enjoy the lives of the things that should happen to righteous people. Okay, Rachel, you're trying to communicate on screen. You're saying there is an audio link. Maybe specify exactly where the audio link is. I personally don't see it. So when you're writing to Chaim, so let him know where the audio link is on the screen. Thank you. Okay. And just make sure that he has the same browser you have, Rachel, when you're speaking to him. Okay, so any questions so far? Everything clear? Let me just go back to class now. Is everything clear?
Yes, so far.
Okay. All right, so far all he did was he isolated the three components of a person, and then he started talking about how there's many conflicts. And he's setting this all up because we need all this background in order to appreciate how he's going to address our verse. Okay? So we'll just keep going. And he says, let me see if there's one more over here. Right, so another place he says there's no actions or decisions or knowledge or wisdom in the grave. And another place he says there's a time for all things, including death. So one verse, it sounds like he's berating death. Another verse, it says that there's a time for it. So another contradiction. And he says, and you're going to find many more cases like this in this book. And Ibn Ezra says, and you should know that even the most simplest of wise people, meaning the people of the least, you know, measure of intelligence, would not write in a book that they're authoring and then contradict themselves. So what is he telling you that for? What is he making that statement for? He says that even the people of the most minimal intelligence would not put together a book and contradict themselves in their very own book.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So I presume that this is designed to be essentially a giant flag for the reader to stop and say, well, wait a minute, there must be some other message here. Because even a fool wouldn't put together a book like this, and these obviously weren't fools, so there must be something else here he's trying to get at.
Okay. Hey, 1 second, let me just help the person on the screen here. Okay, I agree with you, Doug. Meaning to say that to make a blatant contradiction, not just one, but numerous, is a giant flag grabbing the attention of the reader to know there's something going on over here. And perhaps even the statement of the rabbis was purposely leaked. Meaning when they made the statement that the, quote unquote, that the rabbis, the wise men of Israel, wanted to store away the book of Kohelis, perhaps they made that statement as they were following the lead of Solomon. And they knew he was a great intellect, that God gave wisdom to this person miraculously, where he never did this before at any point in history. So I thought once that maybe that is an intentional secondary flag that the rabbis are they're leaking out a sentiment, and they want people to see that there's something going on different about this book, and they wanted to hide it away. They didn't, but they wanted to hide it away because of all the contradictions. So that would bring a focus to the actual contradictory nature of the book, and that, like, you know, like you're saying, Doug. Okay. So again, so the rabbis, they wanted to hide away, and they didn't. And Ibn Ezra now says that even the most minimal intellects would not contradict themselves in the book. And then Ibn Ezra goes on, and he says, one of the commentators needed to try to make an excuse for this word, Koheles. What does it mean, Koheles? That's the name of the book. But in Hebrew, Koheles means like a gathering or a group to congregate. And he wanted to say, one commentator wanted to say, why is the book called Koheles? It's a gathering, because it's like the gathering of Jacob, meaning to say that the students gather together statements of Solomon, and they made a book. Meaning to say that that's why you can have contradictions, because it was written by many people, many authors. But this is not right, Ibn Ezra says. Ibn Ezra says, this is not a correct statement at all. As he says, and more, he quotes, you know, words where King Solomon calls himself Koheles in the book. And it's one person. Koheles is referring to one person. This is offered by an individual, King Solomon, who referred to himself as Koheles. Why? Rabbi Chaim once explained, because he spoke in the group of the wise men. So he wanted to let the reader know that when he gave over his ideas, there were other people that could have spoken up, but they didn't. So he wanted to show that I tested my ideas against the group, the congregation of Israel, of the wise men, and they agreed with me when I wrote this. So that's why he called himself Koheles. But it's one person. It's a reference to one purpose. And the proof, Ibn Ezra says, he gives another number of proofs, but he says, what's the real proof that Koheles is not a group of students, but it's referring to King Solomon himself, because he quotes a verse in the book itself, and it says, quote, I am Koheles. I was king. So there you see clearly, knockout blow, Ibn Ezra shows that it's not written by many people. It's written by King Solomon himself. Okay. Just to get out of the excuse why there's so many contradictions. So don't try to answer why there's so many contradictions in this book because there's many authors. No. It's one author. All right, so that's clear. Okay. And he said that the Torah itself testifies on Solomon that after him there never rose a wise man like him. And we should know that his words are not contradicting. Rather, they are all proper. All of his words in the book are true to those who understand and to those who are upright, that are straight thinking, and those who can find wisdom. Okay, so now he makes a statement and he gives his own opinion. He says clearly that, no, these contradictions can be resolved and he will eventually resolve them. Okay. Now I'm going to explain to you, he says, in a very abbreviated manner, even though that these three souls are called by one name because they come together, I'm going to give individual names to them. So now he's going to go back to the three parts of of a person. And as he's saying, he wants to say the soul of a person is also called Ruach and Nefesh. He's giving Hebrew words over here. And so also I will give names to them in order that I should not elongate in their form. And now he says the first name that I'm going to give that for the part, the component of man, the force in man that eats and enjoys and has happiness and has desire for sex, This we're going to call nephesh. All right, so if you want to just write down, we're going to use those words, nephesh. And this is what controls all, has the capacity of, again, of happiness, of sexual, of eating. Okay, so basically the desires. That is called nephesh. And then the next name, the second part, that has the capacity of sensation, of perceiving, perception. And it also desires rulership, meaning ego. You see right there, this is called ruach. So ruach is equivalent with ego, right? Nefesh will be equivalent to the id, if we use Freud's terminology. So we have the first two. And now the third part of man that has wisdom is called neshama, soul. All right, so let's refer to him as, we'll call him the id, and the ego, and the soul. Okay, so we'll use English words. Again, the id being that part of man which wants just to fulfill desires, urges. So it just seeks after, it's pushing forward. It's proactive from the day we're born until the day we die. And it's constantly seeking enjoyments and food and lusts and urges. The second part, and now he includes a new component, and the second part is now called the ego. That's which has the ability to perceive sensations, right? To perceive the physical world through the five senses, to sense the world, and also a desire has ego. And the third part, okay, so the second one is called ego. And the third part is called the soul. That's what gives us intelligence and speech. And he says also, so did the rabbi Sadia Gaon divide up the human being into these three components. Okay. Now he starts going into the actual workings and interactions of these. And this is really why, when I was reading this, I thought this is very, very useful here. Evidently, Ibn Ezra as well. That's why he took the time at this point to give you all the background, because without really understanding all this, we won't be able to understand this verse. Okay. Let me just stop here and see if there's any questions or comments before we go further.
Rabbi, you've used up ruach and nefesh, and then you're saying the third part that we described before, the third of these three forces, he's calling the soul.
Right.
What's the Hebrew word for that? Because you used up the two Hebrew words that normally are referred to as soul. So what is Ibn Ezra actually using in the Hebrew for that third part?
Neshama. There's a third term, neshama.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so now he moves on to discussing how these components work with each other. Very interesting. Okay. And it is known, okay, I'm quoting him, it is known that when the id, the lusts, are overpowering on a human being, the soul will become weakened, and it will have no strength to stand before it, because of its body, because it has a body. What does it mean? Let's just stop. Let's take it slowly now. And also he says, the instincts strengthen it, or strengthen her. That's why he also says, that's why it is stated, those who involve themselves in eating and drinking, they will not ever become wise. Okay, let's take that statement again. I'll read it to you again. It is known that when the instincts, the id, the urges, the lusts, become overpowering on a person, so then the intelligence, the soul, will have no power to stand before it. Why can't it stand before it? Because the instincts have a body, and all the other urges strengthen it. And therefore, whoever is involved in eating and drinking will not ever become wise. Not that you can't eat and drink and enjoy yourself, but if that is your focus. Okay, so what does he mean that because it has a body? So, you tell me. And he's telling you that clearly the soul will not be able to stand before it. Forget it. There's actually a sforno that addresses a verse in Genesis when God is telling Adam the relationship between him and the snake. So, you can conquer the snake by stepping on its head, but it will conquer you by biting your heel. So what this can mean on a metaphoric level is that if the snake is that which caused the, is a metaphor also for the instincts, meaning there was a real snake, but it also had a parallel in terms of how it operated. It works just like the instincts, meaning if you step on the head of the instincts, God is telling man he will succeed. But if not, the instincts or the snake will bite you at the heel. What that means to say is that if a person, what's the head? Head doesn't just mean the top part of a being. Head also has the connotation of the beginning. That's what we say, the beginning of the year is the Rosh, the head of the year, Rosh Hashanah. Shana is a year, Rosh means head. So why do we call it head of the year? It means beginning. So God is telling Adam over there, is that if you step on the head of the snake, meaning if you crush the beginning of the instinctual urge, when it first approaches you, when you first feel the urge of the instincts, if you can control it and stop it, then you'll be successful. But if not, if you let it swell, if you let the emotion swell inside of you, then the instincts will bite you in the heel. The heel means at the end. Meaning at the end of the battle, if you allow the instincts to swell and you don't fight them off right at the beginning, so then you will not stand a chance. And that's what Ibn Ezra is saying over here, that if the instincts overpower a person, so then the soul will have no ability to stand before it. Because this is the design, that once they get the head start and you don't fight it right at the beginning, and you don't see that, you know, like a person says something to you and you want to lash out and retaliate, and you want to take revenge. If you can control yourself at that moment, that's where you're going to have the most ability to control the instinct. But if you let it swell and you think about it and it starts, you're getting so burnt up inside and you allow the emotion to grow, then you will not have any success in battling it, and you're going to have no control and you're going to speak out against the person. You have free will, but if you don't use it at the right moment, then you lose it. Meaning there's going to be an uncontrollable element to the emotions. And why does he say this is true? Because it has a body. What does that mean?
Rabbi, may I say?
Yes, why? Go ahead.
Yeah, the body gives it additional strength. All the abilities of the body, for instance, whatever the emotion might be, the body can conduct the act of seeing through that the emotion is acted out. I'm not sure I can explain exactly. I'm trying to bring it to a point. If the emotion is that the soul, whatever the emotion is that it wants to steal, the body has the ability to do that act. It has the hands to take. It has the legs to run away from the scene. I'm not sure I'm explaining it properly, but does it make any sense?
Well, I could ask you, the body can also be used to control this, not to do it.
Exactly. In other words, it could be used either way.
But that's not what he's saying.
The body
has
the strength to do this.
But King Solomon is not saying that. King Solomon is saying that the instincts will overpower and win because it has a body.
I'm confused. Okay.
He's trying to explain why, if you're not doing these things.
I have the fluid in my head, but I'm not explaining it properly. When the soul has a body, is it not stronger? Can it not act out things either way, in a good way or a bad way? The soul is just the soul, and doesn't have the body to conduct the act, then the soul is acting on its own. It's not influenced.
But we have a body. I don't know what you're saying. We have a body in this existence.
Right. I'm talking about when the soul doesn't have, what's the word that's used when the soul does not have the body? That's what I'm referring to, the contradiction, the two of them. There's two different souls, one that has the body, one that doesn't have the body.
No, you're making a mistake. He does not say that the body is only in relationship to the id. The body's here. The body's here whether we're functioning through any one of these three forces. But what he's saying, what he's trying to explain is, again, I'll read you his words. I mean, that's what learning is you have to just listen to what his word says. And it says as follows. And he says there's not going to be any power in the intelligence to stand before the id, right? The soul can't stand before the id, ba'avor hayosa guf, because of the existence of the body. So he's saying, why is it that it is impossible for the soul to battle the emotions when the emotions overtake? He's saying there's a reason. So what I think he means, I think it's a very subtle point, and I can't say I'm 100%, but I think what he means is like this, is that unless somebody else has, I want to take away the opportunity to suggest. Did you want to continue, or is there somebody else?
No, I'm listening because I need to clarify this. I need to hear what you say and what the other people can point out to me. Thank you. I'll wait. I'll listen.
Rabbi?
Yes?
I don't know if I'm off track here, but it seems like that part gets an early start. We start out as, you know, children that are operating off of, you know, their senses and things, and it isn't until later on that we develop the intellect to control those, and so it's actually stronger unless we can engage the intellect to discipline it.
Okay, so you're talking about where it says in by Noah that why God destroyed the earth with the flood, because man's instinct is evil from youth. They had a head start. That's
right.
True. That's true. That's not the point here, though. His point is that the soul of a person, meaning the intelligent part, will not be able to stand before the emotions, and it will cave in. And the person will choose to go after the lusts and the urges. Why? Because on account of the existence of the body, and all of the instincts strengthen it.
Have I?
Yes.
We wake up hungry, we gain thirst. When we desire something, our appetite for that increases, our stomachs growl, we salivate, whereas the intellectual pursuits don't have any sort of salivary glands to increase that desire.
So you're saying that because there are experiences throughout the day that are sensual, so that's something which is an unfair advantage, and there is no parallel in the intellectual realm?
Yes.
But what about ideas? The mind can see ideas, and there's objects of enjoyment for the soul, too.
They don't immediately present themselves, that's what I mean.
Okay. All right, I agree with where you're going. I agree. But I want to, does anybody else want to give an answer? Okay, so Jim, what you're saying is I agree. I think what he's saying is that the reason why the soul will not be able to fight back against the emotions when they overpower him is because the battle is not just being played in the mind. Right? Because the emotion is the sense. Again, there's the ego that's in between. It's like, you know, when you're younger, you see the cartoons and the images of a devil on one shoulder and an angel on the other shoulder. So that's basically what they're depicting, that the person's in between. He's got to make a decision, and he's being pulled by both sides. So there's in his mind, there's a conflict. But what Ibn Ezra's saying is there's more than just that. There's also the experiences, like Jin, like you're saying. There's a body. So the body is something which now is on the other side of the scale is unevenly balanced. And I agree with you that on the side of the emotions is also a body, which is very real to a person. And I think that's the important thing, is that it's more real. That's what I believe he's pointing at. Because if a person is really in the life of wisdom, and he can overcome that notion that the physical is more real. The truth is just the opposite. A person who follows intelligence realizes that there are laws, that there are systems that are governing the universe. So what is more real are those systems of truth. Without those laws, without those laws that are governing the maple tree to constantly grow only maple leaves every year, that tree will not. The laws are not inside the tree. Laws are something which are abstract. But a person doesn't start out that way, which goes back to a bit to Cal, to your point. Or was that Francesca?
It was Cal.
Cal, okay. Okay. You guys sound the same. All right. So you see the point. The point is not only that there's the experience, but I believe that the person is giving more reality to the physical. That's what I believe Ibn Ezra is saying, is why is it that the soul can't battle? Because the battle is not, this is the first point we have to come to, is that the battle is not, you have to like read the Ibn Ezra and see what he's saying. The battle is not just in the mind. The battle has another playing field, and that's the physical realm. And since that's something which a person gives more reality to, he sees the body, he feels the urges, right? Food goes in my mouth, it's a very real thing. So that's something which is much more real to the person than he gives into it. He's convinced that that is the good also, as Rabbi Chaitva explained, that a person can only do that which he really is convinced is the good at that time. So his reality and his principle about what is good for me right now is now being governed by the sensations. It's being governed by the lusts. Okay. Rachel, you're writing a question. Let's see. Is not here the duality of this world, thirst, hunger, etc. And beyond this world, the soul's thirst for hunger? I'm not sure the question. Rachel, if you could write that again, not clear. And the ani, meaning I, here is referring to the ego. The person that's in between is being pulled, the one that has to make the decisions. So there's the person that's sandwiched in between. That's what Ibn Ezra said at the very outset. The ego, that part of you which has perception, and you see things, and there's a feeling of the self, that is the part that makes the decision. And we hopefully align ourselves more with truth, and that should govern our decisions, and realize that giving in to urges, although they feel good, it can be damaging. Okay, so that's the first step he makes. Okay, so because we have a body, and because it's very real to us, I believe that that is where he's going. Not just that it's experiential and it starts at the beginning of the day, but we give more reality to it. Do you see that point? That's an important point. And that's why he also says that whoever indulges and makes the focus of his day eating and drinking, he will never become wise. Why is that? And there was also the point here that he says that also, because all the other instincts strengthen it. Meaning to say that he's being convinced by the other instincts of the physical of really being the true, the real good that I should go after. All right, so Rachel's also writing. The person says, I need to eat food for the body and food for the soul in this world of matter. Okay, true. And in this world that's physical, the soul is really an alien, meaning it's detached. True, that's what we're saying, Rachel. Very good. Okay. Right. So to extricate oneself from the pull of the physical and the sensations is very hard. Since also, he says the second reason, is that the other instincts strengthen the current one that's pulling you at hand. And that's why he also says that if a person is involved in eating and drinking, he won't become wise. Well, what does that have to do with anything? But he's explaining an example that how is it that the other instincts are also going to contribute to the one you have at hand, because they all work together. The more a person is involved in the instincts, if he eats and drinks, so when it comes to a decision that has to do with whether I should decide in favor of a lust or in favor of something intelligent, since I am strengthening other instinctual parts of my nature, that has pull on the current one. So although right now I have a decision, do I take revenge on this guy or not? Well, if I'm not a person who's overeating and so on, I'll have an easier time to remove from giving into that, taking revenge, speaking bad. But if I also eat and drink and I give in to the sexual very much, then I have a very passionate type and I'm strengthening the passions. So now when it comes to another decision in the passions, it's going to be weighted towards going towards the passions. Because what Ibn Ezra is trying to tell you is that they're not isolated. The emotions are not isolated. They affect each other. If you strengthen one, you strengthen the other ones. That's why he says if you eat and drink, if that's really your focus, so then other areas will become more impassioned. Okay. So he says a lot here. But I think luckily so far we're seeing his points. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So is this talking about disciplining? Those who are disciplined have an easier time than those who just sort of let their emotions run rapid?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
If you're more disciplined, so when it comes to the decision that's, you know, emotionally weighted, you'll have an easier time battling that emotion, since in general you're disciplined. And you have the ability and you've conditioned yourself to step back, let the intelligence come in. But a person who's always going after what feels good, and now another feeling, because they all share one thing. They all register as feeling good, whether it's taking revenge, whether it's eating this food that's very bad for me, whether it's sexual activity with somebody prohibited or somebody permitted but at the wrong time. So since they all register as a feel-good type of sensation, and a person constantly conditions himself to go for the feeling good, so it doesn't matter what the feeling is the next time around. It could be speaking bad about, you know, about somebody, but that has the equal register on the instincts as that'll be satisfying in a sensual way. So he's conditioning himself to cave in to sensual satisfaction, which they all share. There's different feelings, right? Eating something is a different experience than a sexual act. And that's different than an act of taking revenge. But what they all do share is that it hits a part of the psyche which there's a satisfaction. And that's what he's saying over here is can be cultivated from one emotion, and it'll have the same expression on another emotion. It's a very interesting phenomenon. All right. But now he starts giving a little bit of a remedial cure. But how can a person, so it goes further. And he says, but when the soul joins with the ego, it can succeed over the id and the lusts. Interesting statement. But when the soul, the intelligence, joins with the ego, meaning the part of the person that has arrogance and that's the one in the middle, then it can succeed over the instincts. And then the eyes are a little bit opened of the soul to understand some proper ideas, some proper truths. Therefore, or maybe however, but the person still is not able to understand the higher truths because of the power of the ego. Interesting statement he just made. On the one hand, the instincts overtake you, that's it. You're dead in the water. You cannot stand against them because of what we explained. But if the person will team up his intelligence with his ego, then he can succeed over an emotion. Let me give you an example. A person is running for political office. and he really hates his opponent. And the id, that first part of him, that first force, that desires, that id that goes after lusts and pleasures and breaking down somebody, would love in a televised debate to just start calling this guy names and pulling out all the dirt that he has on him, and to just be seethingly aggressive, because that is a capacity in a person, is just to be seething and venomous and to have completely no restraint. However, this guy he's matured. The guy's in his 30s, his 40s, his 50s, whatever. So what I mean by higher truths, somebody's writing on the screen, what I mean higher truths is to understand true ideas about God, real, the highest level of knowledge. Truths about God's creation, how the world operates and how God operates, as opposed to lower level truths, maybe like math or science or so on. I'll explain that. I'll elaborate. But let's just use the example. So Ibn Ezra is saying this in this example, that if the person, this politician, will team up his soul with his ego, then he can overcome, and he won't start berating his opponent on TV. And because what will the person do? He'll use some intelligence to know, and he'll team it with his ego, meaning I want power. Now the desire for power, the person will have to use some sort of cunning to get it, because he realizes, well, if I just go out and I let out my venom against this guy, people are going to look at me as like uncontrollable. They don't want a guy like that in office. So he understands that. And so therefore, the desire for power overrules the desire for the instinctual, to just be venomous against his opponent. So he'll use some intelligence to cultivate his discussion and frame his statements in a way where he'll still be able to get into office. So he's catering now one emotion for the other. So the ego is now something which at a certain point in life is going to become more valuable to the person than the instinct. And he wants to have fame and honor more than he wants to have, you know, steak and wine. And that happens in life. A person does graduate. But now Ibn Ezra says, this is how you can make inroads to become a wise person. Let the intelligence now team up with the ego. So you're still catering to something which is not a very good goal, but nonetheless, what happens is that you'll engage the intelligence. Now at least the intelligence is being engaged. You're operating with it. And look what he says. And he says, then the eyes of the person, of the soul, will be able to understand some proper ideas. The person will now enter, he's saying, the person now enters into the realm of intelligence, of thought, ideas, which he couldn't do before because the emotions were overpowering him. So it wasn't until a certain point of his maturity that the ego came in, and he desired that more. He'd rather not be looked at as a glutton and a hedonist. He wants to have a certain image. Respect becomes something important to a person at a certain age. What do my peers think? Yeah, this is exactly the whole problem of why teenagers are in turmoil many times, because now they're concerned about what people say. A five-year-old kid in play school doesn't care. There's no concern whatsoever about reputation. He'll go over, snatch a toy from the other kid that he wants. That's it. There's no question. So now this is mine. But when you get older, you need the approval. That's something which is part of the design of the human being. So the desire, the need for the approval now comes in. So Ibn Ezra's saying, if we harness that and we team it with the intelligence, so then the intelligence now becomes engaged. The person's now involved in intelligence for the first time in his life. He can start seeing truths, but not yet the higher truths, because he's still only using intelligence as a means to the ego. And that's what he says. I'm quoting now, continue. And the reason why he can't see the higher truths, he doesn't get involved in just pondering the universe for its own sake. Why? Because of the power of the ego that desires to have dominion over people. And this is what gives birth to anger. And that's how we explain our verse. And now we can explain the verse to mean like this. When it says that better is anger than happiness. Because the matter is that with this anger, with the frustration of what happens when he's going after the rulership and he frustrates, I guess, when he has anger. I mean, what's the anger coming from? He's involved in now the ego, and he's angry because he really wants to get this position over his competitor. But when he's involved in that, and he invariably will meet with some frustration, nonetheless, that anger is better than just happiness, meaning just going after satisfaction. Because now the anger is something which only comes about because he used intelligence with the ego to battle against the instincts. And that produced, when he didn't get what he wanted, it produced a certain state of anger. Or it could mean that the anger is that he is frustrated not going after the actual instinct itself. But nonetheless, what's happening is he's removing himself from the instincts. There's a production of anger, and that's what this verse means. Better is anger, right? 7:3, better is anger than happiness. Because with frustration, the heart is improved. The soul is improved, he means. What is the heart? He said earlier, the heart means the soul. So how is the soul improved? Meaning when you engaged the intelligence to help you get to the position of power, but nonetheless you did engage the intelligence. That's what it means. The soul is improved. The soul is now entered into the equation. Beforehand, you weren't using your soul at all. Okay. Let me just stop here. Let me just see if that's the end of this thought. One second. Yeah, and he goes on. It says that the matter of the heart, this is the intelligence. But then he says, after the soul, the achar should discover in Hashem. So then he says, now the third state is now after the soul has now used the ego together to overcome the instincts. Then the soul needs to be involved in wisdom as its own end in order to strengthen it until the soul can now overcome the ego part. Even though it teamed with the ego before, now it has to be involved in intelligence for its own sake, and then it will abandon any desire for the ego. And then the ego will be subjugated under the intelligence, and he won't be serving the ego as he was before, but now the soul will be ruling every part of the person. Okay, let me stop here. See if there's any questions or comments.
Rabbi?
Yes.
This seems like sort of a natural development of what happens to us as we grow, and some people stop at the middle stage where the ego is.
That's true. They never get to the point where they can get past the self. I've seen that. But it's an interesting dynamic. It really is very interesting how he really spells it out. And he shows you how this tremendous wisdom had to be held by, something which King Solomon had. And his statement now makes perfect sense. So anger better than happiness now, because anger is really, it's not the anger per se that's better. It's the anger is now indicative of the fact that the intelligence is now engaged and you're frustrating some part of yourself. Oh, if you can frustrate a part of yourself, that means that you're not giving in to the real desires. And that's a good. You're moving away from just caving into desires. Okay. Okay, say what? So, I know you have another class. There's a lot to digest here. We've said a lot, and there's still more that he has to say. And then he's going to start going in to actual cases that we've taken up already and cases we haven't taken yet. But most of them, I think, we will have already covered. We are, you know, way past the center of the book, so I think we'll be able to see all the examples he gives now. But now that you give this foundation, I would say think it over, review it, see if there's any questions, and you'll just let it gel and see now that you see the components clearly and how they work. And what we'll do is we'll pick up from this area next week. All right? I don't want to do too much. I think this is a good amount, and maybe you'll have some questions. If you do, feel free to, you know, communicate during the week. You don't have to wait till next Sunday. You know, just send an email or call, whatever. All right? Clear to everybody?
That works, Rabbi. Thanks very much.
Okay. Good. Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Okay, so look forward to continuing next week. Same time.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Good week, everybody.
Good week.